So our commencement speaker is Holden, and today is his 22nd birthday.
My name is Holden. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to welcome anybody here that might be a visitor. I'd like to welcome anybody here that might be a newcomer. I'd like to welcome anybody here that might have a court card. And I'd like to welcome you to the process of the insanity of recovery. I started drinking and partying when I was about sixth grade, you know. And prior to when I started doing that, I used to, I don't know if I was ever like a normal kid, and I got in a lot of trouble when I was younger. I used to steal cigarettes from my mom and go smoke them and steal candy from stores, you know, when you go into the stores, you know. So I kind of had the ism before that ever started. And but when before I started drinking and doing the party and stuff, I used to play Pop Warner football. I used to mow lawns. I had paper routes and did that kind of stuff that normal kids do. Man, I'm kind of nervous up here when I look at that over all these people. Woo! Anyway, once I started drinking and partying and doing all the stuff, all that other stuff went out the window. I quit doing the paper route deal, and I didn't want to mow lawns no more. And the football, they wanted you to cut your hair in high school and stuff, and I didn't want to do that. You know, I wanted to be the cool kid and hang out with all the people who were doing the wrong kind of thing. And I kind of ruined my youth is what I did, because I partied from sixth grade on, you know, all through junior high and all through high school. And the common denominator every time I got in trouble was the drinking or the outside issues that I was doing. And I basically ruined my youth is what I did, because I was never able to grow up like what normal kids do, whatever that is. And then when I was in high school, I got into riding Harleys. You know, I had a stepbrother that was into Harleys, and I inherited a bike he had, and I went on this mission to build this motorcycle. And so when I was a senior, I had a three-wheeler is what it was, and so when I was in high school, I started running around with all the bikers on the weekends, you know. So I didn't hang around with the high school kids, and I ended up going out to the bars in the country and the different little towns, because even though I was underage, they would still serve you. You know, they wouldn't let you do it in town, but when you were running around with all these older guys, they would kind of turn their head and let you do that. And I believe this, and I've heard this before, is when you start drinking and using is when you when your maturity stops. You know, your body still grow, but you still stay immature or whatever age it was you were doing. And so I basically stunted my growth when I was about 13 or 14, even though my body grew up and I didn't really mature, and I didn't realize that until I got here. And I was able to graduate from high school. I went to Mount Whitney and Visalia, and most of the kids I would run around with ended up going to continuation. When I got out of high school, I went to college for a while, and I worked in a motorcycle shop, and I was kind of running around with the local outlaw motorcycle club around Visalia. And so when I would get drunk with them, I'd want to join them. And when I would straighten up, I'd think, man, I don't really want, that's not really what I want to do. It's like I'd have a moment of clarity, you know. And the end result of my drinking in 1980, I ended up at a bar one night, and there was a girl fight, and a guy jumped in this girl fight to pull these girls apart, and I pulled him off. And when I pulled him out of there, he stabbed me, and he stabbed me right in the heart. Bam. And I woke up in the hospital with a collapsed lung and a tube coming out of me, and then I had that moment of clarity, realizing that I knew that if I didn't quit drinking, that I was capable of murder because of the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde that you turn into when you drink alcohol. And so I quit drinking. You know, I just white-knuckled it up, and I kind of hung around with them guys a little bit after that, and I could drink Pepsi, and they didn't care, but what I was doing was smoking them little left-handed cigarettes, you know, and I used to take some little white pills that had the crosses on them, you know. And I never liked to drink coffee. I still don't drink coffee today, but in my mind, I thought as long as I take them little pills and I was working, I was doing good, you know. And when at the end of the day, instead of having a cocktail drink, and I'd go smoke them little left-handed cigarettes, you know. And that would calm me down. And I did that for another 8 years after I quit drinking. And when my introduction to recovery was that I had a girlfriend that, her dad was a football coach at COS, And she was a real, real good looking girl. She could have been a model if she would have been on the drugs that she was on and drinking. But he ended up putting her through the ARC in 1988. And that was my introduction to recovery, because I got to go up there on the weekends and do the visitation or whenever it was, you know, where they had the family meetings and stuff. And I did that a couple of times, and about the third time they didn't want me to come no more. And then she got sober is what she did, and she stayed sober for about 90 days, and she was going to the Alano Club, and she was coming by and visiting me afterwards, because I'd lived with her for a year prior to this, and then she went back to live with her dad, because they really wanted her to go to a recovery home or something, but she didn't want to do that, you know. Anyway, what happened is she relapsed after 90 days. And so, and my keen thinking was, I thought, I'm going to come down to the AA meetings, and I started going to NA too, and I thought, I'm going to learn how to control her better. I'm going to learn this lingo, whatever this is. I didn't know what it was, but I knew there was something here. And then she's going to come back. We're going to get the white picket fence and live happily ever after. And she never came back, you know. And I got the gift of recovery over it, you know what I mean? Her dad paid 10 grand back in 88 to send her there, and it didn't work, you know. And I was a walk-in. You know, I didn't go through the recovery home deal, or I didn't get the court card deal. I didn't get the fast-paced thing where people explain it to you. I had to come in this. I felt like the little kid in school when I came into recovery. I had to sit around and absorb this stuff and try to understand and decipher exactly what everybody was talking about. And what they did when I first got here, they used to have the big book, and they used to pound the table, and they'd intimidate you, and they'd say, get a book, get a sponsor, work the steps, and out of self-defense, that's what I did, you know. I got a sponsor, and I got a big book, and, you know, I had to get a couple. The first sponsor didn't work out. You know, he was a biker, too, and he was hip, slick, and cool, but he didn't really walk what he was talking, you know. And so I ended up getting another sponsor, and he walked me through the steps, and I did the deal. And then I got locked into this deal, and I got into service early on, too. You know, they say, I didn't hear it then. Maybe I did, and I just wasn't awake enough then, or still brain dead. But, you know, I got into service early on, started doing H&I. I got into doing service work as far as being a secretary and stuff. And then my main thing with the Alano Club at Visalia at the time, and I did that for so long. And finally, one time somebody told me, they go, we're going to some healthy meetings, you know. And it really made me mad, you know. But I was really devoted to the Alano Club, you know, because I'd been secretary there for Friday nights and on different times. But it really gave me my foundation is what it did. And then I started branching out and realizing there are different meetings besides the Alano Club, you know, in different towns. And there's meetings everywhere. And I was able to raise my son in recovery, you know, and I didn't know how to be a dad. I when he was in seventh grade, he was living with his mom in Texas, and he was coming back and forth. I ended up keeping him. What I learned here is being honest, not lying, not cheating, not stealing. The main thing is not getting loaded and drinking with him, you know. And then he turned out to be a real good kid, you know. And it was not the way I did it, the way God chose for me to do. And it's because of what I learned here from you guys, you know. I've been able to start my life over here. I've been able to start my business over. I've got married here. I've got divorced here. I've had my heart broken here. I've learned how to feel feelings that I never knew how to feel. I learned how to feel emotional pain, you know. I never understood that. I used to see guys crying in the media, and I think, you sissy la-la, you know. And once I went through some of this stuff, I could understand what that emotional pain is, and it's okay for men to cry. I understand that today. I've been blessed with a wonderful, wonderful life. You know, I get up in the morning and I do the meditations. I read them. I get on my little throne there and I read the meditation like I've heard people do. And I get on my knees and pray, and that's how I start my day off on a daily basis. I love recovery. You know, I love the life I have today. I love them goofy friends I got back there, you know. God has blessed me with a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful life, you know. I want to thank Shannon for asking me to share. I was going to tell you my sobriety date, but I don't have to now. I'm having back problems right now, so I had to have her come up here and do all this reading stuff that I didn't want to have to get up back and forth and stand around here. And Shannon was part of my recovery. You know, when she first came around, I can remember, you know, seeing her, and boy, she was a crier, man. She cried and cried and cried and cried and cried, you know. But it, and then Albert was the same, you know, he didn't cry, but he was there when I first came in, you know. And, we, and it's nice to see the bond that we have in Charlie. And, you know, it's so sad of, you know, after you've been here for a while, you'll see thousands and thousands of people coming in and out of these groups, man, and very few of us stay, you know. And I'm just glad that God chose me to be here with you today, and I want to thank you for being here. Thank you. Great time.
Okay, Tim and Smoke Break's over, and I'd like to introduce you to our speaker, Daniel from Stockton.
Thank you, I'm Daniel, an alcoholic. And I never know what exactly I'm going to say when I get up here, so you just got to get whatever happens. I always pray right before I speak. Pray that I'll be honest. Pray that God will give me the words. So before I speak, I just want to give you a little disclaimer. I apologize in advance if I offend anyone. I don't mean to. I just talk. They told me when I first got in Alcoholics Anonymous that I need to talk about my experience, strength, and hope, and that's what I do wherever I go. Sometimes I say things that seem kind of weird, but wait till I'm done before you get pissed off at me. If you're still mad, talk to your sponsor, or you can always have a meeting on resentments tonight somewhere. I come from Stockton, California. I was born and raised there. My mother was born there. We've been there a long time. My mom's dad went there from Guanajuato, Mexico in 1910. So that side of my family's been there 100 years. My father's family came 10 years later from Zacatecas, 1920. A good majority of my family lives in San Diego, about 80%, but 20% of us, or about 19.9, I guess, live in Stockton. There's a couple of strays that live in Visalia. My dad was born in Reedley. He was a migrant farm worker for all of his childhood. My real name is Daniel Eugenio Torres. I tell you that because my parents were afraid to name me in Spanish, because when they were growing up, it was a little different, and people weren't always tolerant of people from other places, just like they aren't always tolerant of them now. And they had it kind of rough. So they chose not to teach us Spanish, and they chose not to name us in Spanish, even though when I got baptized in the Catholic Church, I was baptized in Spanish, because that's just the way we did it. But they didn't think you could do that. And again, I never know what I'm going to say. This is just what's happening, so whatever I think of comes out of my mouth. My dad actually got suspended from school in Stockton for speaking Spanish to his brother on the playground. And all he was doing was asking him what they were having for dinner. But it was against the law, or school law, whatever, however you call that, to speak a foreign language outside of foreign language class. So that's kind of how he grew up, and that's how he felt different growing up, and how he taught us to feel. My parents are the most patriotic people I ever knew. They would stand up during a football game on TV and put their hand over their heart and say the Pledge of Allegiance, or do that one during the national anthem. But they never really felt American. They never really felt like they got there, even though they were both born here. I tell you that because that's the kind of mentality I came from. We were a very big family. Obviously, we're Mexicans. Lots of cousins. So many cousins, I didn't really need any friends, because we all hung out with each other. My immediate family wasn't very big. I only had three sisters, but I have a lot of cousins. And I was lucky enough to know all of my grandparents. Not everybody is. most of my cousins weren't really that lucky. My grandparents were very old when I was born. They were 80, in their 80s when I was born. All of my grandparents were born in the 1870s. We had long lines of family. My parents were the youngest of both sides. But I got lucky enough to know them all. They never spoke English. They lived here for many, many years, but they never really had to, because our neighborhood was pretty much all the same. And you could just speak Spanish forever. But we were a tight family. And up to, as far as I knew, we were a normal family, whatever normal is. People always use that word, we bandy that word about, like it means something. But I thought everybody's family was like mine, right? And we would all hang out with each other. My father was an alcoholic. Not the kind many people think of, certainly not my kind. My father was a nice guy, drunk or sober. He just got drunk every day, as long as I can remember. I never saw him without a beer in his hand. Once in a while, he'd get a little out of hand, but he never swore. He never beat my mom. He never beat us. He was not a mean person. He went to work every single day, sometimes two jobs from April to November. He'd work in the cannery. And during the whole year, he worked with the United States government. After he got out of World War II, he got a job working for Tracy Defense Depot and stayed there for 30 years and was a very good, hardworking man who tried to raise a good family. But he had a problem. And like I said, he wasn't crazy. He didn't do a lot of weird stuff. He never went to jail. Got in one fender bender like in 1955. And gave the guy like $50 and kicked his fender out. You know. Like the most he ever did. Once in a while, he'd get a little crazy with my mom, but nothing loud. My parents I never saw my parents argue. I knew they were arguing, but I never saw them. They never did it in front of us. They would go in the bedroom, and I don't know if they were fighting in sign language or what, but we could never hear them. And literally, my sister, who's closest to me, she's 15 months younger than me, we would actually go up to the door and put a glass on there and try to hear the fight, but we could never hear it. So, but we knew there was tension. My uncles were a little different. They also were all alcoholics, both sides. And they weren't necessarily nice guys, drunk. They might be halfway decent sober, but they were a little different. And I just thought that's the way it was in everybody's family. You know, everything we went to, the guys drank. Baptisms, weddings, birthday parties, funerals, whatever. We didn't have quinceañeras, so I can't tell you about that stuff. And I just thought that's the way I would be when I got older. You know, because that's what guys do. I figured. And we looked like the best part of the family. If you could take all the different families out of our family, we looked like the best ones. Because my dad was a hard worker. We went to church every Sunday. In fact, I went to church almost every day because I went to a Catholic school. And when you're in Catholic school, you have to go to church first. It's like your first class. If you miss Mass, you miss your first class. So I went to church 6 days a week and had religion class during school the whole trip. And I was a schoolboy. I was a good kid. I tried to be good for my parents. I tried to do what I was supposed to do. I worked really hard. I'm very intelligent. That's not boasting. God gave that to me. I didn't do anything about it. I just am. So I was one of those kids who everybody else hated because I got really good grades and I was very polite. And people would say, how come you can't be like them, me and my sister? So that doesn't always go real well with other people. Kind of sets you apart. But I didn't care because I wanted to be good for my parents. I spent a lot of time with my mother's father because my other grandparents died by the time I was 8. So I spent a lot of time with him. My father talked very little. And you can ask Brent and anybody who was with me last night, so do I. I know people worry, can he really talk for a whole 45 minutes? But it's different when I'm up here talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. I was taught by that grandfather, who was a Native American. We think of Native Americans as only people in the United States, but America's a big place. It's a lot bigger than just the United States. We're talking about the Americas. He was an Otomi, so we're descendants of the Mayas, not the Aztecs. And he told me a long time ago, don't speak unless you have something really good to say. So I don't talk a lot. I'm not saying this is good to say, but I just don't talk a lot. I'm not real social in that respect. If you get to know me pretty well, you'll hear stuff. But I'm real comfortable being quiet. Unless I'm talking about Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's something different. That's something I learned that I had to do. And I spent a lot of time with that grandfather because, like I say, my dad didn't talk much. And my uncles didn't talk a lot of sense. They were all usually having too good of a time being crazy. And I would spend hours with my grandfather, and he would tell me about his life. He was, like I said, he was an indigenous person of Mexico. And indigenous people, wherever they are, if another group comes over and takes over the country, they pretty much get screwed, which is what the Spanish did to the Indians there, and the English and everybody else did to the Indians here, and people in other countries did to people there. And he was also an orphan. And in Mexico in the 1800s, there's no welfare, there's no nothing, there probably isn't even any now. So basically, he had a tough life. And he would tell me all about how it was when he grew up. He met my grandmother when he was in his early 20s. He was working for her parents. They were from Spain. And like in the movies, they fell in love the whole trip, you know. But also, like in the movies, when the rich girl marries the poor guy, they cut her off. So he never really associated with that part of the family. He basically stole her out of there. And she got to find out what it's like to be poor, which I don't think was a really good awakening, but it happened. And he would come back and forth to the United States. Most of us know that the Chinese pretty much built the railroads here in the United States, along with the Irish. But at the very end, when they were trying to complete everything, they didn't have enough people, so they contracted with Mexico. And he was one of those people who came over here legally and helped finish off the railroads. In fact, he met one of his brothers-in-law in Kansas, and the guy wouldn't acknowledge him because, again, they cut her off. But he would tell me stories about that stuff, so stuff not a lot of people know. And I just love talking to him. And I had to learn Spanish to speak to him because he didn't speak English. So I'm the only one out of the four of us who learned because of that, because my dad really didn't want us to, because, again, of the experiences that he had. And I just love that guy. I love hanging out with him because I could always talk to him, and he always made sense. When I was in the third grade, I got in a fight with a kid. Remember, I was a schoolboy, so I'm not a fighter at that time. And he beat me up, and I went home crying. And I was about 8 years old. And one of my uncles saw me, and he slapped me. Because guys don't cry. You're not supposed to do that. So he asked me what happened, so I told him. This is the advice he gave me. He gave me a knife. He said, when you see that boy tomorrow, stick him in the eye. That uncle died in prison. Because that's the way he thought. Luckily, even at 8 years old, I had more sense than that. So I went and talked to my grandfather, and he gave me some better advice. When I was 12 years old, my grandfather got sick. I had never known him to be sick before. I know I told you they were in their 80s when I was born, but they were not sickly people. They were not old. They were not frail. They were hard-working people. That same grandfather worked until he was 88 years old in the fields, and he worked hard. In fact, when my dad asked for my mom's hand in marriage, because that's how old, way back then, my grandfather said, if you can keep up with me tomorrow in the fields, you can marry my daughter. My grandfather was in his 70s. My father was 26. My father grew up in the fields. He said, no problem. Later he told me that's the hardest day of work he ever did in his life. That's the kind of guy my grandfather was. But now he's sick. He's in a hospital. He's got pneumonia. And I'm scared. Because he's the only guy that I can talk to. He's the only guy that will take the time to listen to me. No matter what's going on, no matter what's happening, he always had time. And I didn't know what to do. Because I had nobody else. because my father doesn't talk. And my uncles don't make any sense. And you can't talk to women. Of course, you can talk to women. But I was raised that you can't talk to women. So I couldn't talk to women. I couldn't tell my mom or my aunts. Because you just don't do that in my family. So I talked to the only other person I could think of, and that was God. Because remember, I've been going to church every day, 6 days a week, since I was a little kid. I'm an altar boy. I'm a straight-A student. I'm a good kid in a Catholic school. I got a connection, right? I got to have a connection, right? They've been telling me all my life, if you do good things will happen to you. That's not really what they said, but that's what I heard. That's what I thought. So I prayed, and I asked God to keep my grandfather healthy, to get him out of the hospital. And I will go to Mass every day. I will say the rosary every day. I will do novenas. I will do this. I will do that. Whatever Catholics do, it doesn't matter. And I would have done it. I was that serious. I know in my heart I would have done it. But you can't make a deal with God. It doesn't work like that. So my grandfather died 4 days later. As an adult, I realized that at the moment my grandfather died, I was actually praying for him. I was actually serving Mass at the exact moment that he died. So as an adult, I know that's the coolest thing I could have been doing. But as a 12-year-old kid, I thought God let me down. I've been a good kid for 12 years. I've been trying to do everything my parents told me for 12 years. I've been trying to be a good student, a good brother, a good son, a good everything. And God couldn't cut me some slack. Screw God. That's what I said. Not that nicely. And I determined that moment when they told me my grandfather died, I didn't want anything else to do with God or anything about him. I was pissed off. I was pissed off at God for not letting my grandfather live. I was pissed off at my grandfather for dying. I was pissed off at my parents because they couldn't do anything about it. I was pissed off at everybody and everything. And I didn't tell you before, but in my family, men never show emotions unless they're drunk. Then it doesn't matter, right? You can laugh, you can cry, you can fight, you can do whatever. And the next day, if anybody says anything, they say, don't trip, man, he was just drunk. So in my mind, I knew the only way I could let this stuff out was to get drunk, but I can't go to my dad. Even though he's an alcoholic, he's not going to let a 12-year-old kid drink. I can't go to my uncles, even though they're crazy, they're still not that crazy. So I went to a park. Everybody has a park like it. Park you're not supposed to hang out with. And there was a bench on that park, and several people on that park. We call them the fellas. Some people now would call them gangsters, cholos, whatever. I'm old enough that these people were actually pachucos. Only certain people will know what that word means. Some people have never heard that word, but we're actually from that group. And I knew they always drank. I knew they always used drugs. They were not really that much older than me, just a few years. But they were the people my parents said, don't hang out with, don't talk to them, don't even look at them. And I would walk to that park every day because it was on the way to my school. And I saw those guys all the time. I never talked to them because I wasn't supposed to. They talked to me, though, because I was a Catholic school kid. And they thought that I thought I was better than them. I didn't think anything about them, but they just thought I thought I was better than them. And they would make fun of me and call me names and my friends. And you have to understand, people think they wear uniforms now when they go to school. You don't know what a uniform is. We wore black and brown corduroy pants. We wore hush puppy shoes. We wore a white shirt, starched, with a blue sweater that said St. Gertrude's on the side. We looked weird. We look out of place in the neighborhood. But I didn't care because I was trying to be good for my parents. Now this kid who looks like that, they've been making fun of all this time, is going to try to be a part of them. So I had to get a little radical, so I did. I won't tell you what I did. I did enough that they accepted me. And I know many people start with a little, whatever that guy said, a left-handed cigarette or some wine or some beer or a pill or whatever. I took everything the same day. I mean, I just got wasted that first day. I drank, I used pills, I smoked weed, I did whatever they had, I did. And I went home and I think my parents thought I went insane. Because here's this good kid who's always going to school, always respectful, always doing what he's supposed to do, and all of a sudden he doesn't want to go to school, he won't go to church, doesn't want to hear about God, won't listen to the rules. He just, something happened. But I couldn't tell him because I just couldn't tell him. And something happened to me that first time I took that drink, smoked that weed, took that pill. It doesn't happen to everybody, but I'm sure it's happened to most of you. Something clicked. I don't know why you guys started. It doesn't matter. I know why I started. I was pissed off. As soon as I took that first whatever, I did not care. It didn't matter anymore. I didn't care about my grandfather anymore. I didn't care about my parents. I didn't care about society. I didn't care about anything. I was there. And it felt good. I didn't have to care anymore. Problem with drinking and whatever, as most of you know, you gotta come down. Can't stay up. So you gotta take some more. And then some more. And then you do things that you wish you hadn't done. And then the madness started. I don't know how long it took you. Some people it takes many years. My dad started drinking when he was 18. He probably didn't really, really have a serious problem until he was in his 30s. And then had some more after that. But mine was quick because I started early and I took a lot of stuff. And I don't play when I drink or use. I don't do anything else. I didn't build empires and lose them. I didn't buy houses and lose them. I didn't do anything but get wasted. That's what I did. I got kicked out of every school in Stockton at least once because I don't know how to act when I'm under the influence, and I'm always under the influence. I get in a lot of trouble. I get angry easily, and I tend to hurt people. Used to be a person that I heard on that tape a long time ago, his name was John the Indian, and he said, I'm a very sensitive person, I get hurt easily, and I don't suffer well. And that works for me. I'm always mad, I don't like anybody, and if you're in my way, you will get hurt. It's just the way it is. I don't care if you hurt me, it doesn't matter. So I hung with those people for a little while. I never joined a gang. I'm not going to tell you about that stuff. I know a lot of people who did. I ran with some people who started them. I just never did. I always considered myself an independent contractor. If I felt like going on your side, I would. If I felt like going on the other side, I'd go on there. It just depended on what I felt like. It just did not matter. I got into militant radicalism for a while as a Brown Beret. Some of you are old enough to know who they were. They were kind of like the Black Panthers. We did little stuff here and there that I had to pay for later on. But again, I was very smart. I got in some trouble, ended up on probation. My probation officer kind of lied to me. He said, either you go back to school and finish, or I'm sending you to California Youth Authority. I did not know that I wouldn't go over my offense, but he lied, and I bit it. So I did. I went back to school. And it was around the late 60s when we had a lot of race riots that I was involved in. But I was very smart, so I had a lot of potential. So I was one of the first four people from Franklin High School in Stockton to go to California State University, Stanislaus, just because I had potential, not because I had the grades. To this day, I have the third highest placement score in the history of that school, and I was wasted when I took that test. The only reason I know I still have it is because a friend of mine is a professor there, and he checks every year. But he's going to retire this year, so I won't know anymore. Stayed there for about a year and a half, had a 3.7 grade point average, never went to class, just went and took tests when I was supposed to take tests. I was just that smart. Spent a lot of time dealing in Turlock, getting in trouble. Decided I was too smart for that place, so I quit, went to work for the cannery to make big money. And I did. I made a lot of big money real quick and spent it just as fast. I got married, continued to have problems with people, got arrested 27 times in 5 years for crimes of violence because I go off on people at any moment. I used to think because I was so slick, I never went to prison, but I know now that it was just God. I have friends who are doing time for things that I did with them. Luckily, they don't snitch. So I'm all right for the most part. I became a speed freak as well as an alcoholic. By the time I was 22 years old, I was married. I had two children. I weighed 87 pounds. I was 165. So figure what 87 pounds looks like on me. I had no teeth. These are all fake. You just have to trust me. They don't come out. And I spent a lot of time tripping. I woke up one morning, or came to, I should say, under my daughter's bed, with a rifle in my hand, yelling at nobody. And it scared me. Because I hadn't taken anything to hallucinate that day. I mean, when I take acid, I know something's going to happen. Okay, when I do anything like that, I know something's going to happen. But I hadn't taken anything. It was just coming out. And I got scared. And the reason I went to Alcoholics Anonymous is not because the court sent me, because no court could send me. Not because my wife is leaving me because I don't really care. Not because I was sick. Not because I weighed 87 pounds. Not because nobody liked me. But because I don't want to talk to parking meters and light bulbs for the rest of my life. That's why I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wasn't planning on coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just was scared. And in spite of as pissed off as I was with God all those years, I had to ask for help, and I knew he was only one, so I did. And he just planted a little idea in my head, go talk to your dad. Because, see, I had never really heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. I think I saw a movie one time with a bunch of old guys in the mission singing Bringing in the Seas. That was kind of my idea of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I wasn't planning on going there. I just figured I'd go talk to my father. Which is kind of funny because, you know, God has a sense of humor because my father was drunk when I was talking to him because my father's an alcoholic. And I just told him what was going on with me. And he said, I know a man who drinks like you or drank like you. And I'll put you in touch with him. So I went back to work at the cannery because that's what I was doing at that time. And one Friday night I walked out. And there was this old white guy standing at the door. And he said, my name is Ken Watkins, and your father sent me. He said, and I'm going to take you somewhere. And I said, okay. So I got in his car because I didn't have one. And he put me on I-5. We were driving towards Manteca. I never went to Manteca because there's nothing happening in Manteca. And I said, where are we going? He says, we're going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, man, I don't know if I want to do that. But I'm going 55 miles an hour down the freeway in his car. So I don't have much choice. So I went into this meeting. It wasn't quite this big, probably about half the size of this half of the room. It looked like a really long room, though. And that was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. A bunch of old white people. Not what I would have done had I been God. I would have put me in a room with people that look like me, right? But no, he puts me in that room in the town I never go to because nothing's happening there. And I look different. And I know now in Alcoholics Anonymous, pretty much everywhere, there's all kinds of different looking people. But at that time in 1974, pretty much most of the people looked the same. They were around 50. They were white. They were not from where I came from. And I look different. And sometimes when I say how I look, people can't see it. So I'm going to ask Brent to come up here and take this picture and kind of pass it around. This is what I look like. Both of them. Yeah, the one on the left, I was sober 3 years. The one on the right, I was sober 9. I walked in there, I had khakis, I had a Pendleton shirt, I had sunglasses, and it was nighttime. I had a headband on. I did not look like the group. I did not think I would fit with you guys. Because you haven't been where I've been, is what was in my mind. A lot of people talked about what they had and what they lost, and I looked for the differences, right? Because I never had anything they talked about, because I never spent the time to get it. They talked about where they ended up, and that's where I started. I started drinking in Skid Row, and I never left. I didn't drink in bars. I drank in houses. I drank in parks. I drank in doorways. I drank wherever I was, but I wasn't no high-class drinker. I mean, maybe once in a while I ended up in some place, but that was kind of by accident. They talked about blackouts. I don't know if you've ever had a blackout. I have some serious blackouts. I was with my brother-in-law one time. We were driving to San Francisco from Stockton. We just passed French Camp, if you've ever been up there. There's a little sign that says San Francisco, 80 miles. Next thing I knew, I woke up or came to in a jail in Georgia. To this day, I don't know how I got there. I was there with a black guy and a white guy who were bikers, who I evidently had hung out with for about 3 or 4 days. I don't know where I met him. I never saw him again. I have pictures of me at home with people I don't know. When people ask me, have I ever been to Ohio or Baltimore or whatever, I'm not sure. I pass through a lot of places. Okay? That's just the way I do it. I don't know how you do it. Okay? They were not nice people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not saying they were mean, but they were not kind of these... Ooh. They were not the really nice people that you see now that are, you know, they kind of coddle you and all that. They were not like that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And Ken, after that first meeting, he gave me a ride home. And he said, tomorrow you get to a meeting. And I said, well, how do I do that? He said, well, look up in the phone book. It says Alcoholics Anonymous. Call him up, get to me. And I said, well, I don't have a car. And he said, well, then walk. Okay. You know, and I don't know what people are like in the groups that you go to. There was not a lot of sympathy if you were a whiner. Not that I was, but if you were, they told me this, you can find sympathy in the dictionary. Okay. It's between, what was it? Yeah, shit and syphilis. That's right. That's what they said. Okay. If you did wine too much, and you call up your sponsor, he'd say, did you drink? And if you said no, he said, then what's the problem? Go to a meeting. What step are you on? That's just the way it was for me. Service was a very strong point in the group that I went to. It was called Midtown in Stockton. It was the old Midtown. It was on Harding Way. And I had about 6 months sober. And this little guy, smaller than me, He's a cab driver from New York. He had been there for some time, and he said, he had me sign this paper, and what I was signing, and he said, I'm going to pick you up on Sunday. We're going to go to a meeting. So I said, sure, whatever. So I just signed this little paper. He didn't tell me what it was. And next thing I know, we're going to Folsom Prison. That Sunday, went to Folsom, and this is old Folsom. So we went through the yard, went into the education building in the middle of the prison. I know most people would be kind of scared, but just, I mean, I didn't really think much about it. And I sat down in the education room, and all the guys came in. They sat around me, sat around us. And right before the meeting started, somebody poked me in the back, said, hey, Chuko, what's up? That was my name on the street. He's a guy who grew up four blocks from me. He was doing life. He's still there. Something about that meeting was a little different. See, I don't talk a lot. And even worse then. So even in meetings, I wasn't talking a lot. But I kind of thought there was a game that went on with Alcoholics Anonymous. So I thought you guys were all playing it. And I thought I should play it too. So when you called on me, I would say things like, oh, I really like what you said, Brent, and so-and-so, and so-and-so, and everybody was all happy because I was complimenting them, you know, and so they thought I was doing really well, but I was just doing what I thought I was supposed to do. I wasn't talking for real. But in that room, in that prison, with those guys, for the first time, I talked for real. And I felt comfortable in there, even though I had never lived there before. Those are the people I ran with. And I talked real in there, and something happened. And I did H&I for about 20 years after that, because it was a lot easier to do it in there than it was out here. And it helped me a great deal. And I recommend it to anybody. Whatever service it might be, that might not be your thing. It might be delegate, you know, it might be whatever. But get into service, get out of yourself. I was in a meeting for about 6 months. I hadn't changed a lot, as you can see by my pictures, including my attitude. And this guy walked up to me. His name was Jerry G. Nice guy. Said, hey, he said, you've been here about 6 months, right? I said, yeah. He said, so things are going pretty well for you? I said, sure. He says, then why don't you get up off your ass and wash some cups? And I don't know where you come from. People don't talk to me like that. In my neighborhood, if they talk to you like that, they're going to get hurt. And I had a knife in my pocket. It's a big buck knife. And it was open, because you never know when you have to stab somebody. And it was in my hand when he said that. And God intervened, because I knew if I stabbed him, they probably wouldn't let me come back tomorrow. So I washed some cups. And he taught me some humility that day. He taught me that you don't always have to hurt people. He's a good friend of mine now, and I always tell him when I see him, I'm really glad I decided to let you live. And I think he and his wife both are too. But a year and a half after I was in the program, they started Narcotics Anonymous in my town, and I didn't want to go there because those are the people I ran with. And remember, I wasn't too straight yet out here. And I didn't go for a long time. Finally, I did. And I got to have some really good friends on that part of the program, too. I am truly an addict, but I never say it because I just got used to saying I'm an alcoholic. It's just easy for me. Because to me, it was always the same thing. If I got drunk, I got loaded. If I got loaded, I got drunk. I never saw a difference in that. I know there are people who, you know, separate that, but I don't know how to do one. I was here for about 2 weeks. See, I told you I got here when I was 22. On my 23rd birthday, I had been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 2 weeks. I was still taking speed because I didn't know you weren't supposed to. Because they just talked about alcohol. And if you talked about drugs, they would get up and point at you and say, we don't talk about that stuff here. You have to go to the other meeting. So I really didn't know you weren't supposed to. Because I didn't think that was my problem. I thought alcohol was my problem. And I was sitting in the car, and it was my birthday, so they kept saying, oh, have a beer, man. You can have a beer. Come on, have a beer. Come. I mean, like, it sounded like a broken record over and over for like half an hour. Finally, I said, give me a beer, man. Shut up. So they gave me a beer, and that's the only time in my life I can ever remember drinking one beer. And I hadn't drank in a couple of weeks, but I was still under the influence of the other stuff. And something changed again. I know truly in my heart I am an alcoholic. Hope to die. Because about 5 seconds later, after that first drink of that beer, I thought, I could probably drink a beer on my birthday every year. And that would be okay. Just one. And then I took that second sip, and my mind said, I could probably take a beer on my birthday and every major holiday, and that would be okay, as long as it was only one. And then I finished it off, and my brain said, you could probably have a beer on your birthday, major holidays, and everybody's birthday in your family. But remember, I'm Mexican. We got big families. So I knew. I can't do this stuff, man. And I had to make a choice. And in the book it says, and I'm paraphrasing, someday there's going to come a time when there's no human being that can help you. And you need to reach out for that help from a higher power. And that's what I did. And I got out of that car and I haven't had a drink since. And that was June 10th, 1974. Thank you. And I would like to spend the rest of this time telling you how my life has been perfect, and I've trudged the road to happy destiny, and I'm joyous and free, but I'm trying to be honest. It doesn't work like that. And I really like your sweatshirt. It does get real, and then it does get real different. In the first few years, I still spent, you know, kind of here, kind of not here. I never really felt like I was part of it. Never thought I could hang out with you guys. You know, people were nice to me. They were super nice to me. Even though I was different, even though I looked different, even though I was younger than everybody, they always talked to me. They always shook my hand. They wanted me to go have ice cream with them. And I kept thinking, I can't have ice cream with you, man. I can't go to an ice cream parlor with you guys, bunch of white people. What if somebody sees me? Which is really stupid, because my homies ain't going by the ice cream parlor, man. They don't go by there. They're not going to see me anyway, but that's what I was thinking. So I kind of stayed away from everybody. And when I had 5 years, I went to my first conference in Stockton, and things kind of changed. I just kind of felt like maybe this could work for me. And then I got really scared. And maybe you understand that. We are the only people who can be more scared of being sober than being drunk. Because I know how to act when I'm drunk. Kind of. I know how to deal with it. I'm not afraid of jail. I can play dominoes. I'm pretty good at handball. And I know everybody there already anyway. I can be sick. It's no big deal. Just drink some more. It don't matter. You know, I can do whatever, but be sober, get a job, like a real job, go every day, pay the bills on time, be a husband, be a father, be a citizen. I'm so straight, it makes me sick sometimes. I don't speed. I know a lot of people do, and that's okay for you if you can. I don't break any laws if I can help it, because if I break a law, I break them all. I don't know which ones I can break and which ones I can't. I don't work like that. I'm all or nothing. So I'm just straight. I'm so straight, I know my kids think I'm boring. I went to a friend of mine's house one day. He was dying from our disease. From complications of our disease. He was sober for many years, but he still had things that happened to him. He had hepatitis C, and he was dying of it. He was a biker. And he looked like a biker, still had really long hair, he had tats all over every inch of his body, and he just looked hard, and everybody hung out would look hard. And the two kids that I had with my second wife, my present wife, I should say my wife, because if I say my present wife, it sounds like I'm looking for another one. Hopefully my last wife. They never knew any part of this. They just know stories, right? And they don't believe half of them because Dad's kind of boring. He doesn't do stuff. You know, he doesn't go anywhere. He's not all crazy. They see some pictures, but, you know, that was then, you know. But this time I was down their house, and all these bikers were there, and the kids were outside, and they were kind of scared because we don't hang around with a lot of those guys. And they were listening to all the stories of these guys, and at the very end they were saying how they were afraid to be around me because I was nuts. And I know they're looking at me like, this is my dad. And he couldn't be like that. That's why I bring those pictures, because I am not like that anymore. I don't act like that, I don't speak like that, I don't think like that. And that has nothing to do with how I dress. It's just an attitude. It's a whole different attitude than I had. Because I really didn't care about you. I really didn't care how you felt. I didn't care what I did to you. I figured if I hurt you, you deserved it. But I know that's not true. Ooh. I don't know what happened there. Sure. I spend a lot of time now at the Persian group out in Stockton, which is kind of funny. If you're from Stockton, you know the history of that group. That group was actually started because people wanted to get away from me. We start groups for all kinds of crazy stuff. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous in Stockton, there were 3 groups. Now I think there's 143 fellowships. We have meetings all the time. That particular group, there were some guys who were afraid of me because I was always talking about stabbing people. So they started a group to get away from me, which is really funny because now it's my home group. And I sponsor one of those guys. But that's just the way it works in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I wasn't going to hurt anybody. I was just talking about how I felt. I was mad. And the crazy part about it is I started going to that group 5 years ago because I was in the same place. I had 30 years of sobriety. I'd been working for the same place for almost that long. Yeah. And some weird stuff started happening. And it really doesn't matter what it's about, but it was one of those things where, like, you're going to get fired or laid off after so many years, and you think it's been an injustice. And most people, you know, kind of trip. And every once in a while we read about people who go in after they got fired and they shoot the place up. That's the kind of guy I am. Okay? Luckily, I don't use guns. But I was going to stick this guy in the neck. I had already planned it. 30 years sober. I'm going to walk into mental health, because that's where I work. Okay. I had the little card to get you in through the security door. Okay. I was going to walk up to the guy who was firing me. I was going to stab him in the neck. I was not planning on getting away with it. I knew I would get caught. It didn't matter. Okay. I hadn't been going to meetings for a while. I should tell you that before. So my thinking started to change. I started thinking I was a little too slick again. It had been quite a while since I had gone regularly. Because, you know, after a while you start thinking, well, you know something. Some of us do. Some of us who are sicker than others. And I just kind of went sporadically. I didn't even realize my thinking had changed that much until that day. And I walked into that meeting. They put me on administrative leave for some weird stuff, which is kind of like house arrest, except it's for work. And I had to actually stay home from 8 to 5 so that I wouldn't get another job while they were doing some investigations and crazy stuff. So I went to the 7 o'clock meeting because I I don't go at night very much anymore, and that was the meeting I could get to. I'd leave right before 8. And I told them. And a lot of those people had been sober for years, but they didn't really know me because, again, I wasn't going regularly. And I think it kind of freaked them out that somebody with 30 years was thinking about killing someone and talking about it in a meeting, but that's what I got to do. And that meeting saved my life. That's the meeting that Melody goes to, the one who was here not too long ago. It's a very spiritual meeting. We talk about God every day. If you don't like God, don't go to that meeting, because you're going to hear about Him, and we don't care. I'm a Jesus freak. I'm just going to tell you that out front. I'm not going to preach to you. I'm just going to say it and leave it at that. I don't care who your God is, as long as you have one. I don't care what your higher power is, as long as you have one. That one works for me. Whatever works for you is cool. Things have changed since that day. Some things got a little worse. I finally left. I retired. Went to work for another program called Youth for Christ. Doing the same thing I did for that mental health program, working with teenagers. I speak 3 or 4 times a week to about 100 kids. Usually kids who are just like me, kids who are in trouble, kids who don't know how to act, basically knuckleheads, and they listen to me because I know what I'm talking about, because I've been there. They don't all change, but they hear it. They hear something I never heard, because I never knew anybody who got clean and stayed that way before I got here. I knew some people that went to prison and looked pretty healthy when they got out, but they were all sucked up in about 2 weeks. I knew some people who got religious and stayed that way for a little while, but usually they didn't make it. I never knew anybody who got clean and stayed that way until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sober for 5 years, and my mom walked up to me and said, "You gotta talk to your dad, because he had cirrhosis of the liver. He was dying." He said, "You need to tell your dad about Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, "What can I tell my dad? My dad's going to look at me and think I'll never get as bad as him." And he'd be right on the outside, not on the inside. But we talked, and I got him to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we got to know each other in Alcoholics Anonymous. We met each other in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, met each other. See, I knew him my whole life. He was always in the house, but I never knew him. And he never knew me. And we met each other by speaking in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. If I wanted him to know something, I would just talk about it. And one day I realized he was doing the same thing. And we got to be really good friends. And he died sober at 11 years. Thank you. And I know people worry about, you know, calamity, but it's not always calamity that can get you drunk. My mom died when I was about 21 years ago. She was the real reason I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, because she's the reason I stopped drinking long enough to go into DTs, because she told me she would never let me in her house again unless I got some help. And my mom never gave up on anybody except me. And I don't really think she gave up on me, but that's what I thought then. So when she died, it hurt me. And I dealt with it for a long time, and I finally managed to get through it. I wanted to get drunk when she died, but I knew if I made it to the funeral, which is a real big if because of the way I drink, I would be drunk and it would be like slapping her in the face. So I didn't do it. I just stuck it out. Went to a lot of meetings, talked to a lot of people. And a year later, my dad died. And that was tough, too, but I already knew how to deal with it. Not that it was any less, but I knew how to work it. And I did. And he left me some money. It wasn't a great deal of money, but it was money. And the reason I tell you this is because it's not always bad things that happen. You know, so about 9 months later, probate's done, I get this chunk of money. And right before I got it, I started thinking, well, I could take this much money and buy a bunch of drugs and sell them. Not take them, just sell them and make about 10 times as much, because I still got all the connections. I still know what's going on. And luckily, I did not do that, but I got that close. And I had several years of sobriety by that time, probably almost 20. See, because I'm just not right in the head. See? It doesn't matter how long I stay sober, I'm still a sleazy dope fiend underneath. See? I still think like that first. Then I have to talk to God again. What I try to do is talk to Him every morning. I talk to Him first so I don't think like that. It's the only way I can do it. Because in and of myself, I always do the wrong thing. I always think the wrong thought. In and of myself, I don't belong here. I never planned on being older than 25. I'll be 60 in June. I never thought I would make it. I'll have 37 years. I have 6 kids, 9 grandkids, and in April I'll be a great-grandfather. And none of that would have ever happened had I not walked in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I don't know what's going on with you, but I do know this thing works. And I know that we have a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition. I know that our real purpose is to serve God and help others around us. And I know without Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not be here talking to you. Thank you. Thank you.